Okay. Hi. Welcome back from your winter break. We all had fun. And then we'll have town meeting break, and then we'll have spring break. And it hasn't been that long a winter yet. You're ready. Okay. And you're all doing alternative spring break and doing good deeds for the spring break. I appreciate that. Good. Okay. We'll miss you. Okay, let me do some business first and then talk a little bit about exercise 3 and what kinds of issues came up in that. Can you hear me in the back, Talia? Yeah, okay. Sounded good to me, but I never know. Okay, we have the eco exam, which is the wrap up for this unit a week from Monday. And so next week we will have class twice. We're going to wrap up the Bronfenbrenner material on Monday. Wednesday in class, we will spend reviewing that and looking at how it's applied. So on Wednesday, a week from today, I will charge you to bring any questions or confusions that you still have about what Bronfenbrenner means and how to interpret it. Bring those. Excuse me. Ask questions, and we will spend Wednesday next week reviewing, going through the whole system as best I can, and answering any of those questions that you have. Would you also then, at the end of next week, like to have review session specifically to look at any other questions that you might have? Yes. Don't care. Okay. Should we schedule one? Okay, let's see if we can do that. Thursday next week, which would be the first. In the afternoon. How many of you would like one then? Anytime in the afternoon. Anytime I can find a room in the afternoon. Okay. Is Friday better? Friday? Morning? Early afternoon, 1 o'clock. Late afternoon, 3 o'clock. Okay. Friday afternoon. How many of you would come if it were at 1 o'clock? How many of you would come if it were at 3? How many of you would come to either one? Okay, then I'll find out when I can find a room. And we'll have a review session Friday afternoon. Okay. Otherwise, feel free to avail yourselves of Talia's review office hours. Her review sessions during her office hours next Monday and Tuesday. And feel free to email us with questions that you may have. Also check out the website, because there is some material there that was used last year in the review sessions. So see if you can interpret the material that's there. Have your own private review session, or if you're in a study group, if you're working with three or four other students, go through that material and see if it makes sense to you. Question? The question is, how should you study for it? The point is to understand Bronfenbrenner's system and all of its components and how they fit together. So your goal is to be able to use it and interpret anything that you run into using that scheme. The best way to study for that probably is to review the book, read the hypotheses, make sure that you can paraphrase the hypotheses. You don't need to memorize them. You don't need to know the numbers or any of those sorts of things. I'm interested in the concepts, not the specifics of his system. There is in the syllabus a one-page guide to the ECO exam, what I expect, and it's very specific. So that would be what I would use since I wrote it, and it's geared to the specific items on the ECO exam. I would refer to that and make sure that you look at each part and make sure that you can do what each part suggests. And use that to think about what questions you might have. Ideally, what you would be able to do is to look at any kind of situation and apply Bronfenbrenner's concepts to it and recognize when you're looking at ideas related to a mesosystem, and then think about all the ways in which mesosystems are defined and how settings can be connected and what makes a good connection between settings in a mesosystem. So what you're looking for throughout is what within the system is good for developmental potential. What activities are going to help people develop? What sorts of activities? What are the conditions of relations that are likely to be good for a person's development? What are the roles? What about roles is important in promoting development? So that's the bottom line. We're trying to figure out whether or not aspects of your social ecosystem, your environment, which aspects of that are likely to promote your development and which aspects of it are likely to inhibit or hinder your development. Okay? And you want to be able to put most of it in your own words, being consistent with Bronfenbrenner. Okay? Yes?
The format.
I don't know. Have you made it up yet, Talia? What format would you like? No multiple choice questions. None. No multiple choice questions. Those will be on the final. We'll save those for the final. It's all objective, which means that you put X's in blanks or write in words in a line, or provide a very straightforward explanation of something that we give you to describe. It doesn't make any sense, does it? You should be able to recognize the definition for each of the major concepts. Okay. And I'll give you the list of the concepts, and then I'll give you the definitions and ask you to match them. Which one of these is the definition of mesosystem? Which one of these is the definition of macrosystem? So those should be all be familiar. you don't have to be able to spout them back, but you do have to be able to recognize them. It's a relatively low level. Just to make sure that you have the basics in hand, excuse me, in hand, so that when we move on after the eco exam, we don't have to worry about those things because you've got them. You've learned them, you've got them, then we can go on and interpret family and family development of family relationships and family transitions using Bronfenbrenner. So this is just a test of whether or not you understand what he's saying, and then we can go on and apply it. It's kind of like knowing how to count before you can do multiplication. Other aspects of the format, we're likely to ask you to recognize out of a list of conditions those that would be good for development. And the format of that question will be something like, which of the following would you do if you wanted to make a mesosystem as positive for development as possible? And then there'll be a list of things you might do. And you have to recognize whether or not those things are improving the mesosystem or not. And the guide for this is what Bronfenbrenner says. So you need to be able to interpret the hypotheses about the mesosystem and see whether or not the suggestions that are given in the test are consistent with those hypotheses. That means you need to understand the gist and the principles behind those hypotheses. So I might ask, if you want to make a relation better for your development, what would you do? If you wanted to make a microsystem better for your development, what would you do? Which of the following aspects of activities would be good for a developing person? And it's all taken very directly out of Bronfenbrenner, as much of his language as possible, and sticking to his ideas. Another part might be to give you some statements. I might give you a little essay, a vignette, and then ask you to read that vignette and then answer a series of simple questions. Name or identify the people in two dyads in this story. Which of the dyads is a developmental dyad or is more likely to be a developmental dyad? Describe three molar activities described in this story. Describe two settings in a particular person's mesosystem from the story. So you're taking a vignette, a story, maybe a newspaper article, and interpreting it using Bronfenbrenner's concepts. I will give you the concepts that I want you to apply, and then you have to pick out the pieces from the story to demonstrate that you can do that. That you know what a molar activity is and you can recognize it when you read it or about it. That you know what a dyad is and you can construct what they might be in this particular story. Straightforward. And remember, it's pass-fail. It's pass, no pass. And the penalty for not passing is you have to take it again. You have to take it again until you pass it. Again and again and again and again. So the goal is to pass it first time, get it out of the way, don't have to worry about it, and then you move on. The problem if you don't study for it and aren't prepared for it or panic in the middle of it, which I know some people do, is that then you have to prepare for it again a week or two later and take it again, and it will sit on your shoulder like a mini vulture and it will nag you until you do pass it, and it will interfere with everything else in your life, and keep you from enjoying your spring break and all those other things. So study for it and pass it quickly. Jill. Usually we allow a couple of errors. No, five, maybe. Maybe six.
I don't know.
I don't know because we haven't made up the test yet. And in part because I've never figured out what the theoretical possibility is for making mistakes. What we do is mark the mistakes and take points off. So you get 0 points off or 3 points off or 25 points off. And then I make a cut and say anybody who got close enough to perfect that they only made five or fewer mistakes passed, and everybody else has to take it again. Okay. So we're looking for perfection or near perfection. Yes. What are you doing up there? You always sit in the middle. Oh, okay. Good. Positive dyadic relationship, right? Okay. Are you engaged in a joint activity? No, you get 50 minus the number of mistakes you make if you pass it. If you don't pass it, you don't get any points for that administration. And when you take it again, the maximum points that you can get is, I don't know, whatever I said in the syllabus, and if I didn't say that, I'll make something up. But it drops each time. And then you get, that's your maximum, that's really what your question was, wasn't it? Okay, there's one way to interpret your question. Thank you for reminding me of how we do this. So the second time, the maximum possible may be 40. And so if you pass it, you get 40 minus the four mistakes that you make, so you get 36. So the possible points that you can get keeps dropping, and that's another reason to pass it early, first time, second time. And probably in the syllabus it says when the number of points drops. I don't know. If it doesn't, we'll make that up. I'm a work in progress. Okay.
Just out of curiosity, how have you been in a class? How do students do in a class? How have you done in a class?
How
have the students done before?
Good question. The question is, what percentage passed the first time around? What would be your fear? How nasty do you think I am? Okay. It typically runs around 50% past it the first time. 50. Half. Okay. Did we have any other business, Talia? The older papers being turned back are up here. Turn in your exercise 3 up here. There is a stapler, I remembered. That was exercise 3. So my next item of business is, what did you learn? Or what did you figure out was impossible? Or what do you not understand about the links between settings? What problems did you have trying to do this?
In hypothesis 40, I wasn't sure if it related to the individual or to the supplemental link.
Okay, does hypothesis 40 apply to the individual links? To the individual or to the supplemental links? Who does it apply to? Who does it say it applies to? The settings, and specifically to the communication between them. Who might be doing the communicating between the settings? The primary link is the person whose mesosystem we're talking about. Supplemental links, other people in those settings who are communicating, and the communication is the link. So, since it isn't specific, I would assume that it applies to any communication between the settings, between any people in those settings. So, I would interpret it as broadly as possible to refer to any communication. So, if that's going to be the case, then to have the most direct communication, the most direct communication would be face-to-face, and that's going to have to involve one of the linking people. Okay. So that's the only way you can have face-to-face communication, is to have a person who is going from one setting to the other. Or, and it raises an interesting question about your environment, people from each setting meeting someplace else face to face and having the conversation. Okay, they're still linking those two settings. Maybe. They may be creating an intermediate link by going to a third setting and having a conversation there. Thank you. No, nobody's ever asked that before, so I've never thought about it before. Okay. Good. Okay, any other? Discoveries or problems in doing the exercise? They're going to be a snap, Talia, to read. They didn't have any problems, so. Yes, Emily. Yep. Yep.
So, I didn't really
know what
you're 38, 28, 24.
You understand what they're all saying, and do you recognize the difference between them?
No, I don't
know. Okay, 38 is about the indirect linkages and what they do. Okay, so it's a hypothesis about the indirect linkages encouraging the growth of mutual trust, positive orientation, goal consensus, and a balance of power responsive to action in behalf of the developing person. So it's about the indirect linkages and what they do. And how they do that would then be through communication or through their interaction with the developing person or with other people. It's about generally setting up an attitude and activities for the developing person through their communication. 34 says, again, the developmental potential is enhanced if the microsystem in each of the settings, roles, activities, and dyads, the microsystem in which the linking person engages, so we're talking about the specific person, if those microsystems encourage the growth of mutual trust, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So they're both going to the same end, which is encouraging development. One is suggesting that the microsystem in the two settings that the person engages in should be doing that. Each microsystem should be doing that. And hypothesis 38 says, in addition to that, we want the other linking people, the indirect linkages, which would include the communication, if that works in the same direction. Okay. So in the case of 34, it's possible to imagine two settings that never communicate with each other, but we want them both to encourage the development of the developing person. Okay? So we want them both to be good settings. Now we're going to increase the linkage in hypothesis 38 and suggest that the indirect linkages between those two settings ought to work in the same direction. Okay. So if they encourage those microsystems that the person develops in to do that. In other words, if your mesosystem is more richly linked as the indirect linkages, and they're working in that same direction. Okay. Now, imagine a situation in which hypothesis 38 is violated. Okay. So here we have two settings, and they're working to encourage the development of the person. But in one of those settings, we have some people who don't like the other setting. They're competitive with it, or they disapprove of it. So their communication, the indirect link, their communication with the other setting interferes with the development of mutual trust. They badmouth the people in the other setting. They encourage behavior that is not going to facilitate development in the other setting. You want to make that more concrete? Two homes, binuclear family, divorced parents. Okay. It's really helpful if both settings are good for the development of the developing person. If dad can create a microsystem in which the kid's development is promoted. If mom creates an environment in which the kid's development is promoted. Now apply hypothesis 38. It would also be a good idea if in their communication and the messages they send back and forth and the intersetting knowledge that they apply, if they also are encouraging mutual trust between the situations, if they are encouraging goal consensus. So dad is saying, no, no, wait a minute, when you're in mom's house, you know, she loves you, she wants you to develop, her rules are a little bit different from mine, but that's okay. You know, you need to do what she's encouraging you to do. Here we're going to do things a little bit differently, but that's okay. You know, you're 9 years old, you can figure this out, and there's nothing wrong with what mom is encouraging. That would be following hypothesis 38. And then communication between dad and mom would be, hey, we do things a little bit differently here, but here's why, and I've encouraged little Freddie to follow the rules at your house. I understand what you're trying to do, and I understand with your new boyfriend and his six children that it's important for you to do things differently, but I've only got Freddie, so, you know, we can be a little looser here. But I support what you're doing, I understand it, and Freddie should follow the rules in your house, and I'll encourage him for that. That's applying hypothesis 38 to mutual trust, goal consensus, those sorts of things. Some of you had a different experience, probably. You know, mom said, dad is a totally inadequate human being and you don't have to do what he says because he's wrong. And saying that to the kid, that's intersetting knowledge. And saying to dad, you're an idiot. That's intersetting communication that does not promote goal consensus and positive attitude. And it's bad for kids' development. Yeah. So if one person is applying hypothesis 38 to promote the kid's development and the other one is subverting that and undermining it, then what you have is they're not doing the best job they possibly could because they're not both following hypothesis 38. One is doing a good job and we want that parent to have primary responsibility for the child. And we're going to knock the other one's head against the wall and encourage better behavior. So what happens in that situation is the kid's development is not promoted as thoroughly as it could be. Or you lose respect for the parent who's not applying hypothesis 38 and you don't invite her to your wedding. Or you say, my father or my mother, that parent, was an idiot for 8 or 10 years and finally came around when I was 27 and figured out how to deal with me. But it's just not a positive situation for the kid. And then there are those situations that are even worse, which is where both parties are setting up intersetting communication and fighting with each other, and that's the worst situation for kids, where parents continue their conflict. Okay. We're going to look at that more systematically when we get to the end of the unit and look at what happens in binuclear families as one example. But it illustrates that the difference in those two hypotheses. I did want to make a comment. I actually woke up this morning thinking about this comment. You wonder what faculty dream about? I dream lectures. I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm dreaming a lecture there, or I'm dreaming a discussion group. It just, it takes over your life after a while. So this morning I woke up and said, there's a comment that I need to make about these hypotheses and why so many of them have the same principles, but they're just a little bit different. And the explanation for that is, A, the conditions of the ecosystem, which, and I said this part, they're all saying sort of the same thing and encouraging development. But they're looking at it from different perspectives. So the ones about relations will mirror the ones about the mesosystem, which will mirror the ones about the microsystem. And that's because Bronfenbrenner is taking the perspective from different parts of the ecosystem. But the other reason for that is that he's trying to present this as a set of scientific hypotheses. And if you're doing science and you want to compare or you want to test hypotheses, it helps to isolate specific factors. So he's focusing in a particular one, in 38. He's focusing specifically on the indirect linkages. In another one, he's focusing specifically on the supplemental links, because those would lead you to do different observations to test them. Okay? So he's setting up a series of hypotheses that differ in one element, because that tells you how to go about doing the research, how to do your observation, what to focus on. Okay, that's why it's so redundant. The principles are general, and he's applying them to different parts of the ecosystem, and the hypotheses are specific, and they're redundant because he's trying to focus us on each of the particular elements. Our task is to understand each of the particular elements and then be able to put them together and think about the general principles. We need to do both. So, but yes, they are confusing. They do overlap. And ideally, none of them conflict with each other. If it's a logically consistent system, they don't conflict with each other. And I think if you go back and look at it in that way, that's what you'll see, that they don't conflict with each other. And after you go through them enough times, you begin to get the rhythm of what he's describing. Yeah. That the relationships and the microsystems and the activities, the mesosystem connections are all similar to each other, because those are the general principles of the relationship between the environment and development. And that's what it's all about. That's the bottom line. How is the environment related to development? Okay? Thank you, Emily. Anything else come up in doing exercise 3? Okay. So what's next? How about assignment 4? Isn't this is really neat. It's organization. You did assignment 1 and then 2 and then 3 and now and what comes after assignment 4? Good. All right. Again, it's in the syllabus. It's on the website. But, and I don't have the criteria described here. This is bigger. This is a bigger assignment. It will take you more space, more time. More analysis, and for that you get more points. This is the opportunity to apply the whole scheme to an episode in your own life. Okay. So, describe an important event or series of related events in your life. Let me add to that that if you do not want to write an autobiographical piece, you do not have to. I will assign you one, but you have to come and ask. And I don't need to know why you don't want to write about yourself. I just need to know that you want, and I'll give you something from a novel or something. But most of us like to write about ourselves, and my guess is that you're already thinking about how these concepts apply to your own experience. So this is an opportunity to do that. Take a particular experience or related events. Explain how they had an impact on your development. So the key here is that when you think about an experience, it should be something that probably had an impact on your development, because that's the second part of the assignment. In your own words, how did this affect your development? You know, and that can be fairly simple. It screwed me up for the rest of my life. I'll never get over it. It made me the perfect person that I am today. Don't use that phrase. It made me suspicious of all dogs, and I still have whatever you think it did to your development. And then you have a description. Go through it and see if you can find in your description an example of an ecological transition, a molar activity, a change in your developmental status. So for each of these, you're going to have to go back to the definition and make sure that you're using the definition and find an example, if you can, from your description. So you're doing your own translation from your experience as you've described it into Bronfenbrenner's concepts. And then for each of those, explain. Just explain enough that we understand, that you understand, how this particular aspect of your experience, as you've described it, illustrates the concept from Bronfenbrenner. Okay. And if you don't find illustrations, maybe you need to choose a different experience. You don't have to find illustrations for them all. On the other hand, if when I read it, I find, you say there's no ecological transition, and I find three of them, then we will have a difference of opinion. So make sure you really can't find it in your description. Because if I find it, then I'm going to say, well, you missed this one. Okay. Okay? It'll take you 3 to 5 pages, at least, maybe more, and maximum points are 25. Okay, for this one. Yes. Yes. The question was, can we elaborate on, can we build on something that we've already used, and you used it in exercise 1 or 2 or 3? Yeah. That would kind of be ideal. We won't remember what you wrote about before, but if you use the course that way, you build from a smaller piece to a bigger piece. And that's usually helpful. But you don't have to. So it's just, yes, you can, and we won't know whether you did or not. So, yes. Do you need to label something for what it is in your original description? No. In the analysis, yes. Okay. So if you're describing things that might be molar activities in your description of the experience, okay, that's separate. Then when it says, can you find a molar activity, find it and then tell us about it, so that we understand that you understand that it really is a molar activity. Okay. And so we'll know, oh, this is the molar activity. You can make a list. Just make a list of the concepts as we have them there and just label each one. Describe a little bit about it. Anything else? That's due. It's due. Mark 7. So we have the eco exam on Monday the 5th, and then this exercise due on the 7th, on Wednesday. And when you turn it off, and turn it in, then you're off to that experience for spring break that seems to put smiles on some faces. I don't know what they're going to do. I want to find out what you're going to do. Okay. Last time, we talked briefly about the notion of a closed activity network. I'm going back to mesosystem connections now. And I think I explained that fully. I don't think I need to elaborate on it, except it made a starting point that if you look at a mesosystem, sometimes you will see that there's this group of transcontextually dyadic people who go from setting to setting together. And they engage in the microsystem in each setting together. And they may have 3 settings that they do that in, or 4 or 5. They all engage in other settings with other people, but to the extent that they move together as a pack, Okay. As a group, move from setting to setting and participate in these settings together, they create a closed activity network, a network of settings in which they all engage in the same activities and the relationships carry over from setting to setting. And for Bronfenbrenner, the potential is that that kind of activity, that kind of group moving from setting to setting, can be good for your development. And the explanation for that is because it gives you people who've shared experience with you, so you've got joint activities, and you can talk about the activities and the people and the roles and the physical settings with them when you're in other settings. So it helps you develop a more articulate and differentiated view of your experience in each of the settings, and it enriches the experience, the relationship that you're experiencing with each of those people. So, for example, a family moving from setting to setting, they have dinner together at home, they go to church together, they go to the Y and have fun together, they go to grandma's house together, they go to Smuggler's Notch and ski together. They're doing a closed activity network. They're seeing each other in different roles. They're engaging in different activities together. On the way home from grandma's house, they can talk about how grandma's doing. They can talk about what daddy used to do when he was a little boy and grandma was much younger. And they can compare that to other things. He can say, for example, when I was your age at grandma's house, we did the following kinds of activities, and that's why we do them at home now. So there's a similarity between what I did as a child at grandma's house and what we do now, and that's where I learned to do it. And when grandpa was alive, he used to take me skiing, and we went to Smugglers. And that's where I learned to ski. And that's why it's important for me to take you skiing at Smugglers. Okay? So you can share that kind of information and develop tradition by understanding the next concept, the developmental trajectory daddy has been through. But you can also then think about him as a little boy. Oh, he was once a little boy? How many of you think about your father as having been a little boy? He was a little boy, and grandma was his mom. And, gee, that's interesting. So what was your relationship like? And you can compare that to relationships within the family. You can talk about traditional kinds of relationships within the family. You can say things like, my mom and dad never did anything with me, and that's why I think it's really important for us to do things together. You're creating a belief system, a value system, by talking about the similarities and differences among the different settings. Okay? That makes sense? The closed activity network is good because it allows you to enrich all of your roles and activities and see people in a variety of roles. Remember the hypothesis about the variety of roles that you engage with and that you engage in. That's more likely to happen, or it's going to happen in a different way, in a closed activity network. And some families do that a lot, and some families don't. Some families do it for a period of time and then stop doing it, and that's an important change in the family. Many of you have good friends that, if I pushed you to define who was in your family, the question we will ask about March 7th, we'll start with that question. Who's in your family? Some of you are going to want to include good friends that you have now. And my guess is that if you think about the people that you consider family, who are not in fact biologically or legally related to you, but the people you really think serve the function of family for you, that you have a closed activity network with them. And it may be that the closed activity network is an important part of being a functioning family. That you share settings, you engage in activities in different settings with each other, you present yourself as a family in different locations. That helps other people recognize who you're related to. Oh, you're part of that family. Yeah, we see you every Saturday at Smug's. Love the way you interact with each other. What a boost for family. So my guess is, and you can test this out for me, that those people that you think of as serving as family members who are not technically part of your family, that you probably participate in a closed activity network with them. So let me know if I'm right. Email me. Okay? So that's the closed activity network. And then where we left on Monday, more than a week ago, before Valentine's Day, was with the notion of developmental trajectory. And the developmental trajectory brings into our understanding of the mesosystem the sequence of settings and how the activities in those different settings may build on each other. And the examples we can develop, I think I suggested school was one. So if you think about all the places you've been in a school-like setting, from the childcare that you went to the preschool, to kindergarten, to first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Many of you had a different classroom every year, so it was a different setting. And then you went off to high school, and maybe you had lots of different settings. And then you're in college, and some of you are going to graduate school. A couple of you are already in graduate school. If you think about each of those as a setting, and each of those is a setting, you participated not all at the same time. So you went from one to the next, to the next, to the next. So it creates a sequence. And then for Bronfenbrenner, the important thing is, what was the connection between the activities that you engaged in each of those settings? And he wants to see whether, over a period of time, in those different settings, a pattern of motivation and activity got started. Okay. So a combination of motivation to do something, a particular activity, that begins to do a couple of things. One is it carries over to the next setting and is consistent with the expectations in that setting. So in childcare, you learn to relate to adults who weren't your parents. That's a big deal. And you learn to relate to them when your parents weren't there. That's an even bigger deal. There you were in a setting where your parents weren't and other people were in charge and there were other kids. And you figured that out, but you didn't learn to read because it wasn't a really good childcare. And then the next year or 2 years, you went off to preschool. Same deal, similar microsystem, except that they did some literacy activities. They read a lot. You learned to draw letters. You learned to do your own thing with a pencil or a marker and what you thought might be the letters in your name, and you learned some phonics. And then you went off to kindergarten and they did more of that. And then you went into first grade and they did a lot more of that. And by that time, you were a pretty good reader and you were a pretty good writer. And so when you got to third grade, you looked forward to reading and you did it on your own in fourth grade. So you were developing a pattern of reading that you then carried over into other settings in addition to school, and writing. So by the time you were in seventh grade, you decided you were going to keep a diary. So you're going to write about your experience. So that's a pattern of motivated activity that you're then making more expansive. And then you got to college and lots of reading, which is really, really good. Okay. We wish it were good. Over spring break, do good reading. Unless you already did it, read The Six Stages of Parenthood by Galinsky. Take it with you to the beach, wherever you're going, Georgia to build houses, whatever you're going to do. Take it with you, and it'll be the best thing you've read all semester. And you write. And if you really like this stuff, the reading and writing and learning and reflecting on what you're reading, then you go off to graduate school. That describes a developmental trajectory. Because the activity that got started, probably in preschool, maybe at home, got reinforced and strengthened in the different settings. We build our culture around that developmental trajectory. Education is a major part of our culture, our macro system. We value it. We have laws about it. We support it. We spend billions of dollars. We argue about it. We train people to teach in it. And we reward people who do carry on the pattern of motivation to do well in school. And we try to change the people who aren't getting it. If you're not motivated to learn, to read, to write, and you're not doing well, then we fire your principal. Or we wonder what's going on with your family, because it's a highly valued trajectory for us. Okay? So the trajectory includes the settings that you go through and the activity that is consistent and gets elaborated as you go through that. Question? Let me reframe the question. What is the relationship between molar activity and developmental trajectory? Developmental trajectory is the progress of a particular molar activity, how it becomes molar, and why you continue to do it. And it also reflects, I'm going to get away from the education trajectory to look at a different kind. It also reflects the directive or guiding function of a molar activity that is in a developmental trajectory. Let me look at this one. Pick one out of a hat. Suggest one. Another molar activity. Basketball. I knew you were up there. Okay, where are the rest of you? Oh, you're all there, okay. You're just not raising your hand. Okay, we're going to use you. When did you see your first basketball? Or basketball substitute? 8 years old. 8? When did you go to your first basketball game? Okay. Where was it? Hometown high school. Okay. So you went to a game. You saw one. Okay. When did you have your first hoop on the garage? Never had one. I'm reminded, not everybody lives in the suburbs and has a garage with a hoop on it, right? Okay. The point is, Playing basketball started someplace. Okay. This is a setting. I don't have a clue how to draw the lines on a basketball. Okay, so we'll just label it. So we started basketball. And that happened in some setting. And then you moved on to another setting where you played basketball. Got an idea how your developmental trajectory went? From... Okay. A basketball camp?
Yep.
What age? Okay. Okay. Mini camp. 6 years old. Why would a kid go to a basketball mini camp?
To get better.
So you already have some motivation. So here it is. Somebody is supporting that. Somebody is saying, okay, hey, there's this opportunity for you to go develop your skills. So you go to the mini camp. You play in grade school?
First team
was middle school?
Yeah.
Middle school? High school?
Yep.
Big camps?
This summer, basketball.
Okay. Okay, you see what's happening? The settings, we're progressing through a series of settings, all of them focused on basketball. How many colleges did you apply to that do not play basketball, women's basketball?
None?
Why not? Okay. Okay, that's the selective or directive function of a developmental trajectory. So the molar activity of basketball has continued and it has gotten more important. And as it's gotten more important, it begins to direct what settings you choose to add to your mesosystem. You're selecting settings that permit you to continue and to improve basketball. Right? And back to college as a coach. No, no way. No, no way. Okay. So that's a role you don't want to play. What if we paid you as much as we pay football head coaches? You're right, okay. For $1 million, you'll become a coach. Okay. Me too, if I could. But since I know zilch about basketball. Okay? So the developmental trajectory includes the molar activity, which is becoming more important, more and more important. You're becoming more and more motivated to continue it. Okay, so the motivational level is going up. It is gradually helping you, directing you into settings that will stretch you and give you an opportunity. And it is directing you away from settings in which basketball doesn't play a part. It is creating a structure to your life, a thread through your life that includes what you don't do. Because the developmental trajectory, as it continues to become more and more important, is directing you into some settings and away from others. So it is taking on the steering function in your life. Okay? And you're choosing your companions on the basis of their knowledge of basketball. You're choosing roles that support basketball. You're choosing activities that are compatible with basketball. So you're choosing a major in part on the basis of whether or not it will interfere with basketball, right? You're choosing courses. So it's taking the developmental trajectory has the let me start that sentence over. The importance of the developmental trajectory over time is that it is directing you into some settings and away from other settings, and it is guiding the choices that you make in other settings because they need to be compatible with this activity that has now become the captain of your soul. It is now taking over, and you need to do things that are compatible with it. So that's the notion of the developmental trajectory. And development is in part a function of the extent to which your life allows that. Does your life allow you to pursue the activities that are important to you? And this one I was thinking about yesterday morning when I woke up. Why don't I play the bassoon anymore? I played the bassoon in high school. I chose to participate in the community band in the summer. I got into college partly on the basis of the fact that I was a bassoon player and the orchestra needed bassoon players. They didn't know that I wasn't good enough to make the orchestra. And I didn't own a bassoon. They're very expensive. So I never played again. I got to high school and got to college, and I played in the summers, the two summers that I went home. Never picked one up again. I would have been a famous bassoon player. I would have had this wonderful musical skill that nobody else has. Got here to UVM, very interesting. I got here to UVM and the guy who hired me had been a bassoon player. And then the next guy we hired had been a French horn player, so we're starting, you know, a woodwind quintet here. But all of us had dropped the instrument, either after high school or during college or after. So what happened was that I didn't have settings that supported my continuation as a bassoon player. Just dropped. And nobody has stuck a bassoon in my hands since then. They probably know it would be dangerous to do that for the bassoon, not for me. Actually, I'd probably blow a gasket trying to get a sound out of a bassoon now. Okay? So, what we have is the possibility that activities will not continue, and sometimes we want the settings, the developmental trajectory to continue, sometimes we don't. Any activity that becomes really important to you, that you're motivated to continue, has a developmental trajectory. Even if it's a bad habit, even if it's drug addiction, even if it's alcohol abuse, even if it's hanging out with bad people and robbing banks, it has a developmental trajectory behind it if it's an important molar activity around which you structure your life. So one of the questions is, how do we promote developmental trajectories that will be positive? How do you take the kid who's not learning to read in sixth grade? What do you have to do to make that more important and to make it possible for the kid to learn to read? Uh-huh. Special education? Maybe. Maybe it's about creating specialized programs which are different activities, different settings with different microsystems and roles in them where people can work on the activities that we want them to be able to do. How do you disrupt an activity, a developmental trajectory that you don't want? How do you take the kid that you can see, the second grade teachers, third grade teachers can tell you which of their kids will end up in jail? They can tell you, and they're very accurate at it in second or third grade. If they can predict that trajectory, what do we do to change that trajectory? How do we make it possible for the kid to get off that trajectory, out of the settings that support that, and into settings that will support something that is incompatible with going to jail? That's a question that we'll not spend much time here looking at, but which is one of the threads through the second course in the fall, the social context of human development. And that's reflective of this hypothesis, which is that the direction of your development is a function of what settings are open to you and which settings are not. Can you continue playing the bassoon or not? Nobody ever encouraged me to continue playing the bassoon. That may have been a blessing. Maybe that's why they didn't. They didn't like my bassoon playing, and I can understand that. They did encourage other aspects of my development. Here I am, 64 years later. What settings are open and closed? If you look at a life that includes a trajectory that is something we don't like, gambling, drug addiction, what settings did that get started in? And what settings were not open that might have disrupted that trajectory? If we want poor kids to have the skills that they need to go on to college and to overcome poverty, what settings need to be open to them? And if we look at kids of color, poor kids of color in urban areas, are the settings open to them that would help them develop the motivation and the activities that are going to do them the service of getting them into the next setting where they might continue to develop and thrive? One of the ways of looking at poverty is by looking at the settings that are not available. Family can't make them available. Community doesn't make them available. Kids can't get into them by themselves. They don't have a basketball mini camp available to them, so they can't get there. They don't have a school setting that is conducive to learning to read and developing the motivation to do well in school. So the analysis of the trajectories that are open to kids and closed to them can help us understand why people develop as they do. Okay, we'll go on to the exosystem and macrosystem on Monday.